Chris S. from the Westfield Living.
What?
Spiritual Awakening.
That's right.
It is the Westfield Spiritual Awakening Group. Put your hands together for Chris S.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's good to be here tonight. You know, there's been some really good AA here over the last couple of years. I've been coming down to some meetings here in Montclair. Montclair historically is very significant in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of the first places where there were meetings, outside of New York City and Akron. So there's the AA here in Montclair goes way back. Tonight I'm going to be talking a little bit about Step 6 and Step 7, but to really do so, I have to recap a bit of Steps 1 through 5 so that it actually makes some kind of sense if you're just showing up here tonight. So much about alcoholism is misunderstood. One of the amazing things that happened in early Alcoholics Anonymous was Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, and the crazy crowd that surrounded them figured out something incredibly significant as far as survivability of alcoholism. And what it was much to most of the people's chagrin, they figured out that you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. You fight it with spirituality. And this was something that was relatively new. Like, I'll tell you what, if you have an illness, alcoholism is now known pretty much as a disease. The American Medical Association has declared that alcoholism is a disease and drug addiction is a disease. So if they say that, I have no problem agreeing with them. But a normal, typical disease, what are you going to do if you get sick? You are going to go to a doctor, probably. You're going to go to a hospital. You're going to look for medication or some type of treatment or process. And for the longest time, people have used those methods. Early on, before the spiritual recovery processes, there were a lot of cures for alcoholism. I read a really great book recently. It's called Slaying the Dragon, and it's written by a man named Bill White. And he did extensive historical investigation of treatment for alcoholism. And some of the treatment processes were bizarre at best. And a lot of them claimed huge success rates. One of the ones that was really famous around the turn of the century was known as the Keeley Cure. And there were Keeley Institutes that were built all over the place. And they had a secret gold cure. That was the cure. And I still don't think anybody knows exactly what the cure was. They kept the concoction incredibly secret. But basically what people believe it was it was 4 injections a day while you were in treatment for anywhere from a month to 6 months of heavy metals. Now, I don't know how much you know about, heavy metals, but they're not good for you. So even when there was some success rates, I bet you people didn't survive too long. And what they would do is they would put you in these institutes and they'd give you the 4 shots a day. They'd give you healthy meals. There'd be a little bit of religious training or whatever. And, there were supposedly some success rates. Well, early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the key events that happened was Bill Wilson going to a place called Towns Hospital in New York City, and he was exposed to Charlie Towns and William D. Silkworth. And what he learned from Silkworth William D. Silkworth, who was a psychiatrist, had some theories about alcoholism, and they really still hold up today. You're You read the doctor's opinion, and it's incredibly profound, some of the statements in there about how alcoholism presents, you know, in the alcoholic. And he was right on the money. He had treated thousands of alcoholics, so he had some real personal experience. And one of the things that he did was he basically told Bill what the problem was. He said, alcoholism seems to be an allergy. Now, an allergy is not the best way to describe this phenomenon of craving that we get when we put alcohol in our body. But back in the 1930s, it was as good as, you know, anything. And he basically said that once an alcoholic starts to drink, the phenomenon of craving takes over. And one drink asks for the second drink. The second drink demands the third. The third insists on the fourth. And the more alcohol that's in your body, the more you want more alcohol. Does anybody relate to, you know, getting blackout drunk? You know, I mean, one hand. and the rest of you dishonest bastards. But anyway, I mean, that's what would happen to me. I would start drinking, and I'd close the bar. I'd pass out. I'd crash a car. I mean, you know, once I started drinking, I got the motor rolling, and I was just grabbing for another drink. At the end of my drinking, this is basically what would happen. I would pass out in a chair sitting at a desk and just hit the floor. And I would wake up, you know, sometime around 1 in the morning and get up. And I would have a big full glass of bourbon and Coke or vodka and orange juice that I had just poured. Now, I was so drunk, I was 4 seconds away from passing out, and I would make myself another giant glass of alcohol. That's the phenomenon of craving. Like, why would you want to drink more? You're tongue-chewing, knee-walking, pants-pissing, not able to operate your own zipper drunk. You know, why would you want more? You know, and it's that phenomenon of craving that happens with the alcoholics. And he also described another thing that's very significant to us, the obsession of the mind. Now, this is very difficult for people to understand. People that treat us for alcoholism don't understand this. It says in the first paragraph of step one in the 12 and 12, it says, who among us wishes to admit defeat? Glass in hand, we've warped our minds to such a state that only an act of divine providence can relieve us of this obsession. You know, that's a serious statement. An act of divine providence is our only hope, because what happens is we don't have a defense against the next drink. We drink no matter what. We make promises and pledges, and we swear to God, this is going to be the last time. I'm never going to do this again. You can believe me. And if somebody takes a lie detector, puts you on a lie detector, and you say, I'm never drinking again, that lie detector says they're telling the truth. They're never going to drink again, because we absolutely mean it. But the thing is, we cannot hang on to that resolve. We cannot make a commitment to staying separated from alcohol and have it mean anything. That's why we die. Listen, we're smart people. We know that the way we're drinking isn't really working for us. We're coming to, and we got a summons with, you know, one more DUI, or, you know, we're not in the big bed anymore. We've lost a job, or one more divorce. I mean, you know, how many consequences do we need if we could just decide not to drink? How many consequences would it take if we were smart people? The first or second time that we shot ourselves in the foot one more time with alcohol, we would say, that's it. I'm not touching it again. And we would not touch it. We wouldn't need a 12-step program where we've got a sponsor that we call, you know, and we do all these steps and take all these service commitments. We would just make a decision not to drink. But that doesn't work for us. And this is one of the real misunderstood parts about alcoholism. At certain times, the alcoholic cannot generate a sufficient will to stay away from alcohol. And they call it insanity, because that's really exactly what it is. When you look at the second step and it says restore to sanity, they don't mean that we're psychopaths or we're schizophrenic or we're completely insane. They're basically talking about our relationship with alcohol is insane. The way we approach alcohol, you know, we can't just stay away from it. And this surprises a lot of people. And many treatment processes, I'll give you, for instance, of how crazy it is out there, the misunderstandings about alcoholism. If I'm powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless about when I'm going to put it back in my body. Listen, I've got experience with drinking again and not even being there for that decision. You know what I mean? It talks about it in the book. The alcoholic finds themselves beating on the bar, asking themselves, how could they have done this one more time? It's unfathomable, you know, just how bizarre this is, because, you know, we don't have the same resolve they talk about in the book about putting our hand on a hot stove. We put our hand on a hot stove, it burns us. I tell this story every once in a while. I was in sixth grade, and there was a kid named Huey. And we called this guy Baby Huey. He was a monster. In like sixth grade, he was like 200 pounds, this guy. He was a big doofy guy, you know. And I would get self-esteem by picking on Huey. And in the junior high school, we had lockers. Everybody had a locker, and they had the combinations on there. So somebody would be in there, you know, changing their books for the next class, and you'd come up behind them, and you'd slam their locker shut. And then you'd walk away laughing, you know, and they'd have to sit there and do the combination again, you know, swearing at you. It was just a prank that you would play. Well, I'd done this to Huey, you know, many times before, as well as, you know, most of the people I liked. And this one time I slammed Huey's locker shut, and Huey was having a bad day. He turned around and he grabbed me by the shoulders and started slamming my head up against the wall. Now, you know what they make hallway walls out of in school? Concrete block is what. And he knocked me unconscious. I literally came to, and classes had started. The hallways were empty. I came to, and concussed, and, you know, stand up, and I try to find my way to class. And I mean, Huey knocked me unconscious. I got a kick out of slamming his locker door shut, but the consequence was he knocked me unconscious. I never slammed his locker door shut again. I had sufficient resolve to never slam Huey's locker door shut again. I never, ever did it. And if Huey was standing over there right now, the last thing in the world I'd do is slam his locker shut. When I was walking down the hall, if he was in his locker, I'd get all the way on the other side of the hall in case somebody else slammed it shut and he'd turn around and see me. You know, I avoided that with every fiber of my being. Now, the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking, every single night, I was rendered unconscious by alcohol. I drank myself into a blackout and I passed out. And I slammed my head on the floor, you know, every single night. Why couldn't I just say, you know, this isn't working for me, I'm not going to do this anymore? I didn't have that power. This is why they talk about powerlessness in the first step. It's why it's very, very important that we understand the level of powerless. Otherwise, we're going to think, I'm going to go to AA. AA is like a big pep rally, you know, yay, yay, we don't drink today. And I'll be reminded one more time, you know, not to put the plug in the jug. And you won't get it. You won't get it. It's a much bigger problem than that. You know, we don't need to be reminded. We need a spiritual awakening. We need a complete transformation in our perception, our reactions, our thinking process to be able to pull out of that powerlessness. That's why so many people come into AA and think it's about sitting in the meetings, think it's about sharing. And I go to AA and I share. And that's how I handle my alcoholism. I share. How many, listen, I've been coming around to AA. My first meeting was in 1984. You know how many people I've seen share their way right out of here? You know, that's not a sufficient defense against the first drink. Going to meetings and sharing is a far cry from a recovery from alcoholism. And if you want to be safe and protected and be able to stay separated from alcohol, you're going to need to recover. You're not going to need to stay sober. We can't stay sober. That's what the first step says. First step is saying you can't stay sober. There's nothing you can do on your own unaided will. You are going to drink again. And I used to hear all the time at first step meetings, you know, first step just means to me, I'll just never take a drink no matter what, even if my ass falls off. The problem with the alcoholic is they drink way before their ass is going to fall off. You know, their ass isn't even near falling off and they're drunk. So that's two parts of the first step. The third part of the first step is the unmanageability. Now, again, it took me a long time to learn this stuff. I had to learn it from experience, and I had to learn it from really good teachers in AA. But I thought unmanageability was when I was drinking. When I get drunk, I get DUIs. When I get drunk, my family leaves me. When I get drunk, you know, I wake up in Topeka with one shoe. You know what I mean? This is what I thought the unmanageability was. That's nothing. That's a consequence of drinking a whole lot of alcohol. A non-alcoholic can wake up in Topeka with one shoe, and they decide, that's it. You know, I don't want to lose shoes anymore, and they're good. I do it over and over again. But the real unmanageability is emotional, it's spiritual, and it's mental. And it looks a little bit like this. On a good day, you're restless, irritable, and discontented until you can get to the liquor store and finally crack open that bottle of vodka or that 24-pack of Bud or whatever you drink. That's a good day, sober. A normal day, we're filled with self-centered fear. We're uncomfortable with ourselves and our environment. We just have anxiety, and we have resentment. We get pissed off. We hold grudges. We're emotionally sensitive. You know, things are always just really burdening us. We have guilt and shame and remorse about the things that we've done in the past. And it's just a complete burden being us. And a lot of times we'll pick up alcohol just to take a vacation from that burden of living in our own head with all those voices and all the negativity that goes on. That's like a normal day. A bad day for a sober alcoholic, they talk about in A Vision for You, the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, coming out of one more blackout, you know, with a crashed car. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Those are the spiritual and psychic repercussions of being an alcoholic. That's the unmanageability. That's the untreated alcoholism. And that's what drives us to drink, that unmanageability. So that's the first step. You know, when I'm working with somebody, I bring them over to my house, and in the chapter Working with Others, it tells you what to do. It tells you what to do. And I do that. I let them read the book first, and then we start going through some of the questions. Questions are more important than answers in Alcoholics Anonymous. To consider something is much more important than to know the answer. So often we know. You know, the alcoholic talking with their sponsor, it's yeah, but, and I know. You know, yeah, but, or I know. That's how we respond because of our unnatural ego. We can't be marginalized as alcoholics. We can't not know. It'll make us look bad. But it's very, very important to go over some of the material in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, more about alcoholism, and there is a solution. It's very, very important to work through a lot of those things and to consider them. Is this stuff true for you? Is this some of the stuff that you might have experienced? It's important to be able to paint. If you're an alcoholic, it's also good to go through this and figure, hey, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, God bless you. Alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. If you find out by going through this work that you're not an alcoholic, that's better than finding out that you are. But if you find out you are through looking at this stuff, you have two alternatives. You know, one is to go on as best you can, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation, or the other is to accept spiritual help. This is basically what step one is saying. What does spiritual help look like? You know, that's the question I had. I was scared to death about a spiritual path. I had no idea what that was going to look like. My first thought was, I'm not going to do well selling flowers in the airport. You know what I mean? I'm just not going to do well doing that with a shaved head, you know, wearing a dress, selling flowers in the airport. It's not going to work for me. I had a complete misunderstanding about the spiritual life and how it's to be lived. So looking at step two, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. If lack of power is our dilemma, lack of power to be able to stay separated from alcohol, then the solution is going to be power. I need power that I don't have to be able to stay separated from alcohol. Step two, we look at that. You know, we come to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves. How I first started to do that was I started to recognize that there actually were people like me in the AA meetings who've been sober a long period of time. Obviously, something was working for them. You know, after doing some historical studies and really getting a lot of experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no doubt in my mind today that there's a power greater than myself that I can access through practicing spiritual principles. I practice the spiritual principles, I get the power, but it's not my power. You know, the sunlight of the spirit they talk about, you know, the sunlight of the spirit will keep us sober. It's very, very important to believe in the sunlight of the spirit. It's also very, very important to know that you are not the sun. You know, I can participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition, but God or that power is what's in charge of keeping me sober and helping me recreate my life. Now this, you know, the concept of God is so misunderstood by so many of us. We've got these preconceived notions. You know, we went to some really bad Sunday schools, or we had, you know, abusive religious teachers, or, you know, maybe our parents didn't have a clue, or there was, you know, people that were religious that we hated. We saw them as very hypocritical. We come into this thing with all this knowledge about religion and about spirituality that this book asks us to set aside. We need to set aside what we think we know about all this stuff, so that we can be open to a new experience with this power. And the great news was, you know, when Bill Wilson was getting 12-stepped by Abby Thatcher, he was arguing with him about religion. Well, you know, this, that, and the other, all those religious people. And Abby finally just got pissed off and said, well, you know, Bill, don't worry about those conceptions of God. Make up your own conception of God. It can be your conception. And this is the real good news in Alcoholics Anonymous. We can start where we are. We can start with a fresh plate if we want to. One of the conclusions I came to a long time ago was I heard a man talking about a talk. He, one of my spiritual teachers did 5 years in India, and he said there was this guy coming to town, and it was going to be a great talk on God, and everybody went, and there was thousands of people there because this was a really revered holy man, you know, a spiritual master, and he was coming into that city to give a talk on God. So he went there, and the guy comes out, and he sits down, and, you know, he's quiet for a few minutes, and the first words out of his mouth were, "There is no God." And my buddy Joe was like, "What? You know, this guy's going to be talking about God. What's going on?" And then he waits about a minute, and then he goes, "There is only godliness." And he starts telling everybody to stop calling a verb a noun. And he shifted this guy's perception about God. When we're talking about God in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're talking more about power than we are talking about, you know, a white-haired old man up in heaven with the ledger book of everything you've ever done wrong. We're talking about a spiritual power that can be accessed through spiritual living that will enable you to be able to recreate your life, overcome your problems, and recover from alcoholism. It's a power. It's not necessarily a set of beliefs. So in step two, I need to believe that there's a power. I have to, because I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it happen in a lot of people. Over the course of the years, I've worked with many, many people, and I've seen the lights go on. You ever work with somebody and the lights go on, and you know there's been a remarkable transformational shift in perception that's happened with that individual? You know, that's getting access to the power. So, okay, I believe in the power. The next step would be to say, how do I get that power? What do I need to do? What do I need to do to be able to recover from alcoholism, recreate my life, overcome my problems? I believe in the power. What do I need to do? You need to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of that power. To turn your thinking and your actions over to the care of that power. To start to buy into practicing a spiritual life. Make no mistake about it. If you're alcoholic, alcoholism is your problem. Drinking is not your problem. Alcoholism is your problem. That's a much bigger problem than just drinking too much. Alcoholism is your problem. Spiritual living is the solution to that. Let's jump forward to the 12th step. If there's anybody else in here that likes to read the ending of a book just to make sure they want to read the whole thing. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these 12 steps, that's the brass ring. That spiritual awakening is what we all need if we're alcoholic to be able to survive. If you can stay sober without a spiritual awakening and you are alcoholic, you're going to be a cranky-ass bastard. You ever meet any of them in some of the meetings? You know, I have. You know, there'll be some guy, kid, you know, when I came around and they told me about it, all these steps and everything, you know, I'd have been right out the door. You just need to just go to meetings and take the cotton out of your mouth and stuff it in your ears or whatever the hell it is. Just shut the hell up and, you know, and just stay sober, put the plug in the jug and keep it simple. You know. Next time you hear one of those guys, you know, do this. Untreated alcoholism. Okay. You know, that's not what I want. You know, whenever somebody would say something like that, you know, if they told me there was a lot of work and steps and all this, I'd have been right out of here. My first thought is you're drastically overestimating how much any of us would care whether you're going to stay in the room or not, you know. Anyway, I gave up judgment back my last run through the steps. So, all right, step three, I'm in. Okay, I'm in. Tell me what I need to do. Step four, personal inventory. We need to start seeing what's going wrong in our lives. What are some of the belief systems and behaviors that we have that are causing us our problems? And the first thing they want us to look at is our anger, because we're pissed at everybody. We're resentful. We're judgmental. You know, we've got nasty thoughts about almost anybody and almost anything. You know, we have a unique perspective on the world that if only everybody else would fall into line, the whole place would just be fine. You know, we're unbelievable. I was in rehab in 1989, early 1989. And here I am. I got hospital plastic on my wrist. I'm being detoxed on Librium. And I'm trying to gather everybody together to follow me. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this place is unfair. We got to get together. You know, they're not letting us use the phone. I mean, what a beautiful example of alcoholism. I'm dying, and I'm worried that it's not fair, you know, that I can't use the phone. Unbelievable. I do a lot of work, you know, in detoxes and rehabs, and it's the most beautiful sociological experiment in the world to just see actual, you know, live alcoholism in that way. It really, really does help help you commit every single day anew to the spiritual life when you see that, when you see that insanity. They're so sick, and they don't even know they're sick, you know. And after a year or two sober, that, you know, they start to realize that, yeah, they're sick, but most of the other people are sicker. And finally, when you head toward recovery, you start to realize that that most people are emotionally ill, frequently wrong, and spiritually sick, like myself. You know, we're all on the spiritual continuum somewhere, and none of us are masters at it. Anyway, the second thing we need to look at is our fear. You know, I was insulted by that because I thought, you know, I'm not a fear. You're saying I'm a coward. That's not the type of fear that we need to inventory. We need to inventory why we can't do a better job with our life. Why are we afraid to step out? Why are we afraid to succeed? Why are we afraid to, and it's more of an anxiety. Why are we burdened, you know, with ourselves to the point where our life is getting smaller and smaller and smaller just because we're uncomfortable with everything? That's self-centered fear. And we need to inventory that. We need to start heading in the other direction so that we can do the things that we know we need to do and have the courage and resolve to be able to do them, you know, without short-circuiting ourselves. The next thing we need to look at is our harms to others, because if you're an alcoholic, there's damage behind you. You know, they call us the tornado. You know, we're like tornadoes roaring our way through the lives of our family, our friends, you know, our jobs. We really are tornadoes. And we need to look at the harms that we've caused in the past. Why? Because if we don't come to terms with them and try to set right the harms that we've done, we are going to continually be affected by guilt, shame, remorse, and self-centered fear. Because we're just not going to feel comfortable in this environment. There's always going to be things that are bothering us and worrying us. So we need to come to terms with that. And the first thing we do is we list them all out. Now we need to share this with another person. Share the instructions basically are God, ourselves, and another person. We need to share this big inventory that we've done. And that's a very significant spiritual exercise, because what usually happens is it's the first time we've ever really been flat honest with somebody about our faults and the problems with our character and our morality and how we've fallen short, you know, in word, thought, and deed. Look, I've listened to hundreds of fifth steps. I've done well over a dozen myself with different people. I know that we're not so different. Most of us have made the same mistakes. And I see mistakes as not necessarily being bad things anymore. You know what I mean? I was talking with somebody on the phone just today, and they were recounting this horrible, nightmarish, you know, exploded relationship they had a couple of years ago. And I was saying, you know, he's going, I never want that to happen again. I never want that to happen again. And, you know, I pointed out to him, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing that happened, because it showed you where you didn't want to go. You know, I've had these experiences in my past. I, you know, until I was about 12 or 15 years sober, I was shooting myself in the foot. I still had really defective relationship skills. I just did. There was still that ego. There was still that. I was still defending my piece of turf. You know what I mean? And no one is going to walk on my piece of turf. I still had all these defense mechanisms, and a bunch of things blew up along the way. And looking back at them, they showed me where I didn't want to go. They showed me who I didn't want to be, and they ended up being very, very positive. If you're an untreated alcoholic, those are going to happen to you over and over again, and they're just going to get worse. If you're practicing spiritual principles, living a spiritual life, what's going to happen is you're going to be able to learn from them. You're going to be able to grow from them. You're going to be able to apply the spiritual principles to them, and you're going to be able to move on. And you're not going to keep shooting yourself in the foot like you always used to. These are very, very powerful exercises and essential for recovery from alcoholism. Now we're at step six, became willing to have God remove all these defects of character. And that's really what I'm here to talk about tonight. Kind of long-winded introduction to step six. But what does that mean? Become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Now, we've admitted that we're powerless over alcohol. We've admitted that without God or without that spiritual power, however you choose to define that power, without that power, we're not going to survive alcoholism. If we haven't come to that conclusion, we haven't finished step one. So if I'm at step six and I'm looking back at my experience with the first five steps, I've admitted that alcoholism is too big of a problem for me to take care of on my own. I spent many, many years trying to fight my way out of alcoholism. I used drugs to try to manage my alcohol consumption. Anybody in here ever use heroin to try to manage their hard liquor drinking? One hand. All right. That is not a good idea. If you're new or just coming back, we are not supporting that as a method of handling your alcoholism. It works for about 5 minutes, and then it gets very decadent and very messy. I tried changing my liquor 100 different ways. I tried geographics. I tried different friends. I tried the marijuana maintenance program. Anybody ever try the marijuana maintenance program? That's good, except you just sit around all day going, "What? Wow." And eating pizza. I mean, you don't get very far. So now I'm looking at my character defects. I've got a big four-step that I just put together. It's my resentments. There's a whole bunch of character defects involved in that. It's my fears. It's my harms to others. I robbed and pillaged all over the place. I let people down. The closer you were to me, the more you got hurt by my behavior, the more misunderstandings there were. I'm looking at all this because I've just finished a four-step. And I've got to admit to myself that if I could have done a better job, I would have done so by now. If this was just about recognizing our problems and doing it differently, step six would say, become willing to not make these same mistakes anymore and move on. But that's not what the step says. The step says, become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Now, by the time we're on step six, we've experienced the power of God because we're sober. We've experienced the power of God because the first five steps have a series of promises that happen to us, and we start to have a spiritual experience, and we start to experience these things in our life. We start to wake up. We start to come to, and we start to believe in a power greater than ourselves, and we start to experience that power. And belief is a long way away from conscious contact with. To believe that there's a God is to think that there's a God out there somewhere. to have personal experience or conscious contact with that God, experience with the power of that God, is like the difference between night and day. And we start to feel this after we've done step five. So we know there's something out there. So for the recreation of our lives, to keep from continually making the same mistakes, we have to engage the spiritual life. We have to get close to this power somehow. We have to be participating in the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That's our part of the bargain. God's part, or the power's part of the bargain, is a recreation of life, being rocketed into the fourth dimension. It talks about in this book being reborn, having had a spiritual awakening, knowing a new freedom and a new happiness. These are all manifestations of the spiritual awakening. So I'm a believer in all this stuff. In step six, I know that my problems, my character defects, my flaws, my sins, my mistakes, whatever you want to call them, are too big for me. Yeah, I can try to work on my character defects, but I've tried that in the past and it never worked. What this book asks us to do is stop trying to be perfect. Stop trying to work on your character defects and do the rest of this work. Place those problems in God's hands. Step six, become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Step seven, humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. Step eight, make a list of all the people and institutions that we've harmed. Step nine, go out and make direct amends to those people. Step seven, eight, and nine are the spiritual atmosphere we have to live in for our character defects to be removed. And if we continue on with this process, that's exactly what will happen. I want to tell a story. I sponsored this guy for 7 or 8 years. He was, he was a city guy. He was a little rough around the edges, but he was working really hard. He had a terrible bottom. He came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, "Just tell me what to do, and I'll do it." And he was working very hard, and he was staying sober. And we were working through some of the steps. And one day, I'm in the 7-Eleven with him. And he picks up a pack of cigarettes. This is when they had the cigarettes like right up in front. They don't do that anymore. And he grabs a pack of cigarettes and puts it in his pocket. And I'm a couple back in line, you know. And then he goes outside. I go outside after him. And I go, "Hey, man, you stole that pack of cigarettes." And he goes, "No." I go, "I saw you take that pack of cigarettes. You didn't pay for it." He goes, "Yeah, that was the rack up front." I'm like, "What difference does that make?" He goes, "Yeah, they know you're going to steal them. They got a budget for them up front." And I'm like, "You stole a pack of cigarettes. You know, come over to my house tomorrow. You know, we're going to have it." And what happened was I got him to understand that what he had done was wrong. And he was very willing. He was working through the steps and he was very willing. He made a list of every single 7-Eleven. He'd been doing this his whole life. He made a list of every single 7-Eleven that he had stolen from. And he was doing okay. He was making some good money. He put envelopes of money together, and he went around to all these 7-Elevens, and he made direct amends, and he paid the money back where he could, you know, where they would accept the money. And let me ask you a question. Do you think he steals cigarettes anymore from the 7-Eleven after doing that? You know, that's the process. That's the process that we engage in for the removal of our character defects. To humbly ask God to remove them, to list the people and institutions who we've harmed, and to go out and make direct amends to those people. And I know from personal experience that these character defects can be removed. Just in this last week, you know, I'm going to share this, and I'm not going to take any credit for it. So if it sounds like bragging, please understand I'm just sharing it, because in 1989, I was such a pathetic drunk that I was living in a room in my mother's house talking to a bottle of bourbon like it was my lover. I had a horrible job. I was wearing clothes I had in high school. I was vomiting out the window because I was too lazy to go into the bathroom to do it. My family had left me. I had not a friend left who would spend 5 minutes with me. I was just the most pathetic person in the world. And I'm telling you, nobody was calling me up and saying, hey, Chris, come over here. Or, hey, Chris, what do you think about this? Nobody wanted anything to do with me. In the last 10 days, I spoke at a conference on addictions. It's called the Cape Cod Symposium on Addictive Disorders. The Friday night speaker was a 4-star general. The two speakers that spoke with me on Saturday night, one of them was the deputy drug czar for George Bush's cabinet. And the other one was one of the very first people who put the Minnesota 12-step model together in addiction. And I'm up in front of hundreds of people talking about what the future of addiction treatment should be paying attention to and what the future of 12-step recovery should be paying attention to. Where does that come from? The other day we're watching a Dr. Phil show. Okay, I don't know if anybody watches Dr. Phil, but last Thursday there was a great show. It was like a crazed intervention. It was like this ex-supermodel who like became a meth addict, and it was just unbelievably bizarre. They ended up having to go out, leaving the studio and talking to her behind a dumpster. It was just a really good show. Well, one of the women who runs the recovery center that they're going to is on that show. And at the end of the show, Dr. Phil says, and the best recovery center in America is run by so-and-so. So-and-so, would you say a couple of words? And this woman says a couple of words. I was instrumental in her recovery. And I'm watching this on the Dr. Phil show. There's a power out there, folks, that you can lock into, that can change your life. And all you need to do is be consistent at following some of these spiritual principles. I've got personal experience with this. Become willing to have God remove these defects of character? You damn right I am. Because there's an unbelievable life to be lived on this planet, right here, right now. There's unbelievable experiences that are available to all of us. The thing that blocks us off from an amazing life are those character defects. And the thing about alcoholism is, inherent in alcoholism is almost an utter inability to recognize how much trouble you're in until you've experienced sobriety. So you have to take some of this stuff on faith. You have to believe that there is an amazing adventure for you ahead if you get involved with this work. That's all I have for tonight. We got it.